Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya. Naram Chaiva Narottamam. Devim Saraswatim Vyasam. Tato Jayam Udirayet. Nasta Prayeshva Bhadreshu. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Bhagavati Uttama Shloke. Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki. Reading this morning from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 90. The summary of Lord Krishna's glories. It's text number 35, and we're going to do a few additional texts as well. Etesham api rajendram. Tanujana madhu dvisaha. Pradyumna asit pratama. Pitrivad rukmini suta. Etesham api rajendra. Tanujana madhu dvisaha. Pradyumna asit pratama. Pitrivad rukmini suta. Please chant. Ete sham api rajendra. Tanujana madhu dvisaha. Pradyumna asid pratamaha. Pitrivad rukmini. Tenor and baritone. Please chant. Tenors or baritone, anyone. Ete shamapi rajendra. Tanujana madhu dvishaha. Pradyumna asit pratamaha. Pitrivad rukmini sutaha. Etesham api rajendra. Tanujana madhu dvashiha. Pradyumna asit pratamaha. Pitrivad rukmini sutaha. Vaishnavis. Etesham api rajendra. Tanujana madhu dvishaha. Pradyumna asit pratamaha. Pitrivad rukmini sutaha. Etesham api rajendra. Tanujana madhu dvishaha. Pradyumna asit pratamaha. Pitrivad rukmini sutaha. Anyone else? Okay. Synonyms. Etesham, of these, api, and Rajendra, O most eminent of kings, Tanujanam, sons, Madhu Dvishaha, of Krishna, enemy of the demon Madhu, Pradyumna, Asit was Pratamaha first, Pitrivat, just like his father, Rukmi Sutaha, the son of Rukmini. Translation. O best of kings, of these sons begotten by Lord Krishna, the enemy of Madhu, the most prominent was Rukmini's son Pradyumna. He was just like his father. Text 36. The great warrior Pradyumna married Rukmi's daughter, Rukmavati, who gave birth to Aniruddha. He was as strong as 10,000 elephants. 37. Rukmi's daughter's son, Aniruddha, married Rukmi's son's daughter, Rochana. From her was born Vajra, who would remain among the few survivors of the Yadus' battle with clubs. 38. From Vajra came Pratibahu, whose son was Subahu. Subahu's son was Shantasena, from whom Satasena was born. 39. No one born in this family was poor in wealth or progeny, short-lived, weak, or neglectful. Text 40. The Yadu dynasty produced innumerable great men of famous deeds. Even in 10,000s of years, O king, one could never count them all. 41. I have heard from authoritative sources that the Yadu family employed 38,800,000 teachers just to educate their children. And text 42. Who can count all the great Yadavas when among them King Ugrasena alone was accompanied by an entourage of 30 trillion attendants? Purport. Srila Vishvanath Chakravarti explains why specifically 30 trillion, rather than an indefinite number of tens of trillions, is stated to be the number of King Ugrasena's attendants. He does so by citing the interpretational rule of Kapinjala Adhikarana, the logic of referring to pigeons. Somewhere in the Vedas is found the injunction that one should sacrifice some pigeons. This plural number should be taken to mean not an indiscriminate number of pigeons, but precisely three of them, since the Vedas never leave any matter vague. The rules of Mimamsa interpretation take three as the default number when no specific number is given. Okay, so apparently the verse says trillions of attendants, and by the scholarship of the Acharyas, they're specifying 30 trillion attendants. Jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Well, this is an absolutely amazing coincidence that I should get this verse, because I actually have a lot to say about this verse. There's a very instructive and interesting pastime of Srila Prabhupada associated with this verse. And I'm going to share that with you in just a moment. It's a pastime that's very instructive for the whole ISKCON movement and for each of us individually. Now, before I get to that, this reminds me of a really good joke. It's a short joke. Can I share it with you? So, you know, the land of my birth, America, is not known for electing the most intelligent presidents, if you haven't noticed. So some years ago, the former president decided it was a good idea to invade Iraq, and he elicited the help of other countries to help with the invasion. So one day, this president was getting a report, what happened with the war yesterday. And the secretary came in and said, well, it was a good day, Mr. President, although 3 Brazilian soldiers were killed. And he said, oh no, that's terrible. How many is a Brazilian? So here there are 30 trillion associates, which is more than a Brazilian. 30 trillion associates of King Ugrasena alone. So many years ago, this verse came up in a discussion with Srila Prabhupada. It was in Los Angeles, I believe, in 1976. He's a very nice devotee, actually a very good poet. I write poetry, and so I'm keen on devotee poets. And this devotee was a really good poet, Can I just quote you some of his poetry real quick? He wrote a beautiful song that was set to music by Mangalananda Prabhu, and it goes, O cold, mechanic, desert night, I'm not your child, I've seen the light. He's talking about seeing through the illusion of material life. No more to wear your dusty clothes, I've felt the thorn, I've smelled the rose. Such nice imagery, right? Material life. There's a thorn and there's the fragrant smell. So let my chanting fill the sky. Let love for you fill every eye. let's see. No more to wear your dusty clothes. I've felt the thorn. I've smelled the rose. Anyway, that was just beautiful poetry. Very nice, intelligent devotee. And he was doing college preaching at that time. So he and his associate came to see Srila Prabhupada in Los Angeles and said, Prabhupada, when we read with the scholars, when they see this section of Krishna book, with the 10th canto, where King Ugrasen had 30 trillion associates, they laugh. They say, where do they put all the bathrooms? So because of this statement, they said, the scholars can't accept Srimad Bhagavatam. What should we do? So Prabhupada asked them, why of all the verses in Srimad Bhagavatam do you read this one with the scholars? Find another verse that they can understand and read that one with them and discuss that one with them. But they objected. But here it is in Srimad Bhagavatam. It says 30 trillion, but they can't believe it. What should we tell them? Prabhupada very patiently again said, just find some verse they can understand and read that one with them. But again, they were questioning, but it's Srimad Bhagavatam, it's Shastra, it says 30 trillion. How is it possible? How can we explain this to them? And Prabhupada said, perhaps for the only time, you do not require a spiritual master. And they left. So this very profound pastime associated with this verse. You do not require a spiritual master. Do you ever hear Srila Prabhupada say that in any other context? He was saying to these devotees, his disciples, that I'm explaining to you, but you're not hearing me. You're not able to take my words with faith. Rather, you're looking from your own perspective and insisting that I square up with the way you see it. So this is actually the only time that Prabhupada dismissed disciples. They were so obstinate about this point. So the issue this raises is called anusar or anuchar. You know the difference of these two terms? Anusar means to what? Take the sarum, the cream, the essence. You know, anukaram, I'm sorry, not anuchar. Anukaram means to imitate. So to imitate or to take the essence. See? We could see the spiritual master is very faithful in Shastra. So we say we also want to be faithful in Shastra, 30 trillion. But anusaram is to take the essence and be able to actually share spiritual life with others effectively. And there's a very helpful story to illustrate the difference between anusara and anukara. There was a veterinarian who had an apprentice. So this veterinarian was specialist in helping big animals. One day he got a call. There's a horse. My horse is sick. So he came over and there was a horse lying on its side, which usually means they're going to die. And there was a huge lump in the throat of the horse. So the veterinarian examined and he said to his assistant, get me a hammer. So the assistant brought him a hammer and he carefully aimed at the big lump on the horse's neck and struck it. And then he told the farmer, don't worry, your horse is going to be fine tomorrow. So the apprentice was watching all this, and he said, well, that's easy. Anyone could do that. So he quit and started his own veterinarian practice. And people would call him, and he would go with a hammer, and soon the people were calling this veterinarian, "This apprentice of yours is hitting our, he's injuring our animals. What's wrong with him?" So the veterinarian called his apprentice in and said, "What are you doing? Well, I just saw you hit a hammer with a hammer. You fool, that horse had swallowed a watermelon." So if we imitate without understanding the purpose, this causes us to make offenses. This is the point of the story about Prabhupada and his disciples. They wanted to express faith in Srimad Bhagavatam, but in the course of doing so, they were offending their spiritual master. So this is the very instructive story for us. First of all, you know, Prabhupada wrote in 1971 that perhaps by 1975, all my sons and daughters will start initiating disciples and carry on the name Bhaktivedanta in the family tradition. This name, Bhaktivedanta, is so nice. It is from the heart, bhakti, and from the head, Vedanta. Both are covered, Bhaktivedanta. If we look only from the intellectual point of view, we might read a verse like this and say, how could we believe Srimad Bhagavatam? But on the other hand, because we have nishta, we have faith in, from the heart in experiencing Krishna consciousness that has blessed our lives in so many ways, we can easily accept something which may not square with our imperfect senses. And so, Bhaktivedanta. Bhaktivedanta, to follow in Srila Prabhupada's footsteps, means to know when to apply intelligence and when to apply devotion. Religion without philosophy without religion is what? Mental speculation. It's just, you know, a mental exercise with no feeling. There was, anyone ever heard of Professor Dimmock? You might have seen his introduction to the old Bhagavad Gita as it is. But he was the biggest specialist in Chaitanya Vaishnavism in America. And so the devotees approached him in 1970 or 1 or 2 when they were publishing Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, maybe earlier than that. They approached him, could you please write a foreword for this? Because he was the biggest scholar in the field. If he endorsed it, it would be very popular with the scholars. So he wrote a foreword, but it was completely unacceptable. And so Hayagriva Prabhu, he thought, well, I'll just rewrite it and go and show it to him and maybe he'll sign it. So he rewrote in a way that would be suitable, took it to him, and he found Dr. Dimmock engaged in reading Chaitanya Charitamrita with some fellow scholars and drinking wine. In fact, they've been drinking a fair amount of wine. They were quite inebriated. So Hayagriva explained his mission, and he showed him the new before, and he said, yeah, whatever, and he signed it. So then it was published, and later he called and said, what is this review doing? I never wrote this. So they produced the signed copy. Excuse me. So the point is, without bhakti, Vedanta is just a mental exercise. It does not have the effect of changing the hearts and the lives of the scholar. On the other hand, to have bhakti without Vedanta, to have religion without philosophy, what is that? Sentiment or fanaticism. Yeah, sentiment or fanaticism. So if we take a statement like this, without, just literally, without bhakti, then we are either sentimental or fanatic. Both things have to be there. Now, what does this mean for us? Well, there needs to be a proper balance in our lives between the philosophy and our feelings for Krishna consciousness. And to make that balance, we have to be sure that we don't take things too literally. Yasya deve para bhaktir yata deve tatagara. You know, only to one who has implicit faith in both the Shastras and the spiritual master are all the Vedas, the imports of the Vedic scriptures revealed. So just this morning, I was listening to a tape of Prabhupada, and Prabhupada misquoted a verse from Bhagavad Gita. He just said one word differently. I knew the verse, and I knew it. The way he was saying it was different. Now, has anyone else ever had that experience? So what does that do to our faith? We could say, Prabhupada made a mistake. How is that possible? There was once a very kind of pushy, enthusiastic but pushy disciple of Prabhupada who lived in Vrindavan. And I will not say my dear godbrother's name. But he was very enthusiastic. So he would come to Prabhupada offering profuse prayers, and then he would ask questions to Prabhupada, like kind of personal questions in public. And he asked Prabhupada about conceiving a child in Vrindavan. Was that all right? And Prabhupada said he should go to outside of the Dham for that purpose. And will it be a son? Yes, yes, it'll be a son. So he then came back a time later and said, Prabhupada, I did what you said and we had a daughter. What happened? So, this is what can happen if we, first of all, we inappropriately understand our relationship with our guru. And secondly, we take the word very literally. Now, I know Srila Prabhupada knows Bhagavad Gita like I'll never know it. You know? But if I'm very literal, I say, oh, he made a mistake. How can I trust anything he says? Like these scholars. Or, well, there was another instance, a very nice conversation, very instructive conversation between Srila Prabhupada and several disciples, including Jayadvaita Maharaj and Satsarup Maharaj. And they're talking about the editing of the books. So this is a very sensitive point. That Prabhupada's books had to be edited. How could we say that anything that came from the lips of the pure devotee would need any correction whatsoever? So when Srila Prabhupada first arrived in America and had a few followers come, practically the first thing he did is give them volumes of his typing to edit. Packed volumes of bundled manuscripts, single-spaced, every square inch of the precious paper filled up with Prabhupada's personally typed writing. And one disciple was an English professor from Ohio State, and he said, can you edit this for me? And he said, yes, I'll be very happy to. So he gave him a few pages, and then he said, okay, well, this definitely needs some work. And he said, that's fine, make it nice. He wanted them to be edited so that it would be appropriate for the English-speaking world. That was his guru's instruction. And how could he present to the English-speaking world if his English was his second language and it wasn't presented appropriately? In the first volume he did of Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada wrote about this. Tadvag visargo janataka viplavo. Right? In the verse from the fifth chapter of the first canto, in which it is said, even if imperfectly composed, these messages will affect the hearts of people. So Prabhupada said, certainly our attempt to present this in the English language, a foreign language for me, will fail. But in spite of that, the message is so urgent that we are certain it will have an impact. So when he had, Prabhupada had to edit all of his own books. If you've ever written a book, if you've ever published a book, it's a huge effort. And one of the greatest things to have is a good editor. If you've seen Radhanath Maharaj's journey within a book, the very first page, he offers his appreciation to a lady named Amy Hertz, who was an editor at Penguin Books, who has inspired the whole thing in the first place. And, you know, having an editor is a tremendous opulence. It's not like something that's a hassle. It helps the writer enormously. So Prabhupada immediately gave his manuscripts to an editor, and he told them general instructions, edit for clarity and impact. So with that, the editors undertook their work. So later, They were asking Prabhupada about how the editing should be understood philosophically. And if Prabhupada is giving some dictation and there's some incorrect English or some even a Sanskrit mistake or something like that, how should they do it? How should they deal with it? At the same time, understanding that their spiritual master is perfect. So Prabhupada said, I'm not perfect, only Krishna is perfect. And Satsarupa Maharaj said very intelligently, so the problem is that we have the wrong understanding of what is perfection. Prabhupada said, yes. So the spiritual master can make mistakes. If we're only in the Vedanta side, that will impact our faith. But if we're in the bhakti side, we see the whole picture. See? On the other hand, if we're only in the bhakti side and the spiritual master is breaking the regulative principles, we say, oh, it's his lila. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this. I just saw it briefly some years ago. But there was some young Indian man who decided to make a complete scam of being a guru in America and see how far he could go. So he gave himself this name and this persona and grew out his hair and, you know, started speaking in flowery language about just completely made up philosophy. And he started getting followers. And he took it on for some years. You know, he got some reputation as such and such. I can't remember the name, but it was quite amusing, actually. After some years of this scam, then he came out and revealed, okay, I've just been bluffing from the beginning. I'm not a holy man. I don't follow these things. Everything I've been telling you is complete rubbish. And still, some of his followers said, no, it's just Gurudev's lila. And when people trying to tell him, look what he's saying, he's just been scamming you the whole time. He said, no, it's his lila. It's his pastime. So this is what can happen if it's all on the bhakti side. Bhakti Vedanta. So nice, huh? So in terms of the greater ISKCON society, Prabhupada said, when you preach, you will make enemies. You know, if you never want to fail at something, if you never want to fail, there's only one sure way. And what is that? Yeah, don't do anything. Never try. Then you will never fail. So ISKCON, Prabhupada tried, let us organize a worldwide confederation of devotees. And there have been many successes and there have been many failures. So some people will look at the failures of ISKCON, its shortcomings, and say, oh, we need to have another organization, or we need to do something different, or at least I'm not going to be part of this organization. I'm too good for such a fallen organization. Like one comedian said, I could never join an organization that would accept me as a member. So, ISKCON, as you know, has suffered so many attacks, and then splinter groups start this way and this way and this way, you know, because there's faults. They see faults in ISKCON. Prabhupada was once approached by a Professor Stahl from the University of California and said, your disciples do these things which are not really representative of the Vedic tradition. He was a Vedic scholar. And Prabhupada wrote back, and he defended them in one sense, on the basis of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. And then in another respect, he said, anyway, if you are looking for Krishna, you'll find Krishna, because Krishna is there. And if you're looking for fault, you'll find fault, because fault is also there. So it really depends on your perspective. So people seeing only fault, look at the imperfections in ISKCON and say, we need another organization. We need to start. And they sometimes gather around other senior Vaishnavas and say, you be our guru and we'll follow you. You know, or they sometimes just band together amongst themselves and say, this organization is no good. We have to break away. So I happen to know this one older woman who many years ago decided to put her money into what in America is called mutual funds. So, you know, do you have this in India also? So the mutual funds are very conservative investment. And she put her money, a modest amount of money in there, and that money grew and grew and grew, and she just kept it there no matter what happened in the stock market. She just kept her money in the mutual funds. And after 20, 30 years, she has $3 million from a very modest investment. Because she just kept her money and refused to move it no matter what happened. The opposite of that is called what they call day traders. They watch the market and they say, oh, this looks like this. So they take their money and they put it here and then they put it here and then they put it here. I'm going to get a quicker return, right, from this investment. So those people, in my experience, almost always lose their money. The market is made for fools like that to put their money in and then take advantage. So to me, these other organizations that have sprung up in the wake of Srila Prabhupada's monumental world preaching are like day trading. It looks like you might get a quick return. You know, you invest over here and then you'll be a big leader. You'll be a big shot. You know, everyone will say, oh, yes, such and such has left ISKCON and now he's leader. And you know, or some say, oh, you're going to get the higher knowledge. Yes, Prabhupada only gave for the neophytes, but we'll give you the higher knowledge. Right? So invest over here. So these are the day traders. The smart people leave their money in mutual funds of ISKCON. So it's because ISKCON may have its faults. It certainly does have its faults. But it's also the only organization that Srila Prabhupada founded. So we can look at it and say, when I go back to Godhead, when I meet with Prabhupada, I'll tell him, Prabhupada, ISKCON was bad, therefore I left. Or we could say, Prabhupada, ISKCON was bad, therefore I stayed and tried to fix it. Which would you rather do? Which do you think Srila Prabhupada would appreciate more? Okay. So to do that, we need Vedanta. We need discrimination, but we also need bhakti. That is an example of balance of bhakti Vedanta. So personally, in our own spiritual lives, we also must balance knowledge and devotion. There are some devotees who feel very strongly about taking literally anything that Prabhupada said. You know, taking just one or two or maybe even a preponderance of quotes and insisting this is the only way to serve Krishna. And if people are doing things in any different way, or maybe Prabhupada at one time made a reference about this or that, and they say, aha, Prabhupada said this was no good. See? Then we will make offenses to devotees. See? I had the experience, and perhaps you've heard other, I was a very fortunate young man to be Srila Prabhupada's disciple. I was not an intimate disciple of Srila Prabhupada, but I met him on many occasions in groups. And on one occasion, our party leader was introducing all of us party members to Srila Prabhupada. So I had that experience. We're sitting in the room. Maharaj said, and this is Kalakanta Das, and Prabhupada looking right at me. So have you heard from other disciples what the experience was when Prabhupada looked at you? Anyone remember? What do they say? Yeah, just looking right through me. And that's what I was feeling at that moment. Prabhupada is looking right through me. And it was not a comfortable feeling. I felt like Prabhupada is seeing all the anarthas. And I felt very unworthy. And I felt like maybe I wish I could just kind of shrink into the floor at that moment. And it was a very intimidating and powerful feeling. But then many years later, Shruti Kirti Prabhu, who was Prabhupada's secretary, he explained something really nice. When Prabhupada was looking at people like that, he was not thinking, oh, what are the faults of this malecha? He was thinking, anyone can guess what he was thinking? How can I engage this person in Krishna's service? So that scan, which was very analytical, it was not a critical one, it was a very positive one. Okay, Krishna has sent me this person. How can I engage this person in Krishna's service? That was the meaning of that penetrating look. Isn't that interesting? So this is how the devotee sees everyone. not what they're doing wrong, but what they're doing right. There's a story of Queen Victoria when she ascended to the British throne. In those days, any capital punishment case had to be brought to the Queen. So the first case brought to her was this army officer who had committed some kind of very heinous crime. And the prosecution was asking for the death penalty. So they brought the man before the Queen, and the prosecutor began speaking. "Your Highness, Your Majesty, he has done this, he has done this, he has done this." Many criminal things. And so the Queen listened and listened and listened. And when the prosecutor finished, she said, "You've investigated this man thoroughly?" "Yes, Your Majesty." "Can you tell me one good thing about this man?" And the prosecutor was quite caught off guard, and he was speechless. He couldn't say anything. And she asked him again, "Can you tell me one good thing about this man?" And he said, finally, "Well, I was told that he was good to his family. Then I spare him." So finding one redeeming quality in another person, that's the mood of the pure devotee. What can I do to engage this person in Krishna's service? The danger is if we use only Vedanta, then we will not appreciate the devotion in this other person. That's very important for our spiritual life, because what's the first offense to the holy name? Yes, to blaspheme the devotees, to find the fault in devotees. So just like these devotees found fault in this sloka from Srimad Bhagavatam, and just like people find faults with ISKCON and therefore abandon it, so people find faults with devotees and overlook what they are trying to do for Krishna. And this is the kernel of Vaishnav Aparad. So there's so many ways to serve Krishna. There's so many ways to serve Krishna. And each living entity, this is the mind-blowing thing, each living entity has a unique way to please Krishna, unlike any other. Now that is truly amazing when you think how many people there are. Now here's something even more amazing. Inside each human body, you know how many cells there are? There's a Brazilian. There are actually 100 trillion cells. 100 trillion cells. Now, each cell, it has birth, it has growth, it has duration of life, it passes off byproducts, it dwindles, and it dies. Those are the 6 symptoms of the presence of a soul, right? So from that definition, we can understand there's 100 trillion souls in every single human body, each one with a unique relationship with Krishna. By the way, only 10 trillion of those souls are human, or those cells, rather, are human cells. 90 trillion cells are either parasitic or syncophantic living entities just waiting for you to die and for the big party to begin. So each living entity has a unique relationship with Krishna. It's unfathomable, isn't it? Jiva Goswami says, the first thing, if you believe in God, the first thing is you have to understand God is inconceivable. We can't even begin to calculate how many living entities there are. There's life everywhere, everywhere. And every single living entity has this unique relationship with Krishna. So it follows reasonably that the way you serve Krishna is going to be different than the way I serve Krishna. It also follows logically, using our Vedanta, that there's an awful lot of different ways to serve Krishna. Countless. So the devotee appreciates the bhakti and looks past the differences in the way we approach service. Because after all, this person is serving Krishna in a way that is different than mine. E pluribus unum, Prabhupada said, unity and diversity. That should be the motto of ISKCON. So, now, We've talked about finding faults in the institution. We talked about finding faults in other people. What about finding faults in ourselves? Here again, we can be on the bhakti side or on the Vedanta side. And we need to strike a balance. If we're on the bhakti side, we're going to be very slack. Isn't it? Yeah, I may not follow the regular principles, but I do chant. I do offer my food. And that's all right. And we'll accept only a very low standard. On the other hand, if we're on the Vedanta side, then we can be even a little neurotic. I have to do this now. I have to do this. It's 5:45. I have to do this right now. I don't know if you've ever seen devotees like that. I mean, that's the external, but the internal is even more damaging. It's damaging because we'll be very hard on ourselves, unreasonably hard on ourselves. And we'll be thinking, like, I have to be perfect or I can't offer my service to Krishna. I have to be perfect or else I'm unworthy of being a devotee. And then we can be very negative of this kind of thinking. Fault finding too much. So there needs to be a realistic balance. That yes, we're not perfect, but we're also sincere. We need to appreciate ourselves like that. And I'm, you know, this lesson took me so many years to understand. So many years when I was thinking I wasn't really worthy of being a devotee, or that I was just inadequate in so many ways. So Prabhupada was in Australia, and my godbrother Charu Prabhu was the temple president. And he told me this story, Charu Prabhu personally, that was not published anywhere, so I'm sharing this with you. It's a bona fide story. I heard it firsthand. So he was alone with Prabhupada in the room after Prabhupada had arrived, and he thought, well, I really want to ask Prabhupada a question. This is a great opportunity. So he asked this question that he'd been thinking about for some time. Srila Prabhupada, once you start chanting Hare Krishna, how long does it take to become purified? And he said, Prabhupada thought for a few moments, and he said, about 40 years. You've heard this story? Yeah, so 40 years. That's a long time. That's longer than I was expecting when I signed up. Now, I've been chanting Hare Krishna for 44 years, and I'm a slow learner, so I'm not there yet. But I am getting some realizations that are really helpful, and this is one of them. That we don't have to be perfect for Krishna to accept our service. In fact, Radharani is very merciful. Lord Nityananda is very merciful. They accept our service on behalf of Lord Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. And they are extremely accepting. So if we're doing our best, and we know that we're giving our best effort to please Krishna, then that effort is certainly accepted by Lord Nityananda or Radharani. They are very kindly accepting that devotion. And if we're not doing our best, that's a different thing. But if we're really giving our best, then we are successful in Krishna consciousness. And we don't have to be perfect. Everything doesn't have to be just by the book. You know, everything doesn't have to be black and white. Krishna understands. You know, I've learned over the years that I can go before Krishna and say, Krishna, this is the best I can do. I know this is not what I would have liked to do. It was not as good as what I had aspired to do, but this is the best I can offer you. Please take it. You get a little belligerent sometimes. Yeah, just take it. It's the best I have. Remember the story of Sanatan Goswami and Madan Gopal? He had this deity he was caring for, and he was very poor. So he had a little wheat he would roll out of chapati. Every day he'd give his deity one chapati. And one day, Madan Gopal said, could you please at least get some salt? Sanatan said, what can I do? I'm sorry, please accept this is all I have. So I've actually understood that this is an appropriate mood for a devotee to have. Not if we have salt, that's a different thing. But whatever we have to offer, we do our best, we offer that to Krishna. We should know that Krishna is kind and he's accepting that. One time a devotee said to Srila Prabhupada, kind of exemplifying this Vedanta mood, "Prabhupada, I am the most fallen." To which Prabhupada responded, "You are not the most anything. Simply insignificant." So this idea, this mental concoction that we have to be perfect, is actually an expression of ego. And so Prabhupada responded by humbling his disciple. It's an expression of ego. I am such a good devotee that I am going to be perfect. And if everything I do isn't perfect, then I really have to beat myself up so it'll be perfect. You see? This is not a devotional attitude. This is a very mental attitude. So a devotional attitude means we accept ourselves with our limitations and we try to do our best for Krishna. So institutionally, interpersonally, and individually, bhakti Vedanta, not taking things too literally, not taking things sentimentally or fanatically. Fanatically is the biggest problem that we face. Just like I mentioned about book changes, you know, this whole thing of where Prabhupada's, have you heard this controversy? You know, Prabhupada's original books were really the only ones he wanted. You know, it's such an unfortunate thing. It ruins so many spiritual lives. If you really study the situation, Prabhupada wanted his books edited. There's ample evidence to that effect. And how they were edited was also, to be edited, was also very explicit. And yet people leave ISKCON and they ruin their spiritual lives saying, "I only want the original books. I only want the original books." They commit offenses to very accomplished and respected devotees saying, "Oh, they were so arrogant that they changed Prabhupada's books." See, this is a great misfortune. It's a good example of literalism, of Vedanta obscuring bhakti. See? So, individually, institutionally, and interpersonally, bhakti Vedanta. This is actually a great lesson from this verse. You know, I was really amazed to get this verse this morning. I mentioned I write poetry. So one of my poetic efforts was to put all of the verses of the 10th canto into poetry. And I did that in a book called A God Who Dances. It took me 5 years. It was so blissful. I loved doing it. And there's 3,600 verses in the 10th canto. So sometimes when I have to give a class on the 10th canto, I think, okay, and like for this class, I didn't have any time to prepare. So I said, "That's all right, I'll just bring out my poetry and I'll read a little bit and that'll get me in the mood." You know, so out of 3,600 verses, there were about 10 that I didn't translate because they didn't lend themselves to poetry. This was one of them. So I said, "Okay, this is interesting." But this story about Prabhupada, you do not require a guru. This is extremely instructive. And besides, you know, King Ugrasen must have had at least 100 trillion associates, right? What's the problem with 30 trillion? He was already carrying 100 trillion in his material body. Thank you very much. Are there any comments or questions? Ruiji.
Krishna. Thank you, Prabhu, for a very nourishing class. Both the head and the intelligence and the heart, both are nourished. There is bhakti and Vedanta both. Thank you, Prabhu. Prabhu, I had a question regarding this intelligence and devotion. This is a challenge we often face, that intelligence is generally in the mode of passion. The third canto also describes that, the, you know, 26th chapter I read about how the false ego transformed into a mode of passion is intelligence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when we try to analyze things and that intelligence, it starts a passionate cycle because there is no end to how much we can analyze. And as you rightly said, we also need bhakti. But bhakti, generally the devotional sentiments, many times it's not there, in the sense, a lot of it depends on Krishna's grace. So how do we connect to Krishna at the same time not giving up our intelligence and not allowing the intelligence to glide down further, because the modes are always competing. Mm-hmm. If we're in sattva, then the mode of passion is pulling us down. And if we're in rajas, So how do we balance actually? Mm-hmm.
We are advised by Rupa Goswami to avoid this prayasya, right? Over-endeavor for some mundane thing which is very difficult to achieve. So the service that we may offer Krishna, although it's unique and it's valuable, it is still, on the whole, it's quite insignificant. Right? I sometimes think that if I die today, what would the impact be? And there'd be a few people who shed some tears, and you know, and everything else in the world would go on. Right? And yet I'm thinking I'm so important, and yet that's the reality, isn't it? Everything else would go on just like normal. So whatever service we think we can offer to Krishna, in the greater scheme of things, it's pretty insignificant, right? So if we are influenced by passion, we're thinking, my service is most important. In this section of the third canto, there's a discussion of devotional service in the modes of nature. Right? So the devotional service in the mode of passion, it's still devotional service, but it's characterized by a sense of separateness. The devotee in the mode of passion always thinks, I'm going to be the best devotee. Can I tell you another joke? This is another good one. So they're in the church. One day the pastor is speaking. And in this church, all the rich men sit up at the front. And the pastor is speaking this very impassioned sermon about humility. And as he's speaking, everyone is very moved. And then one of the very rich men stands up and he throws himself before the pastor and he says, "I am nothing. I am nothing." And the whole congregation is astonished because here's this big man humbling himself. And so the pastor is going on so eloquently. And then another very rich man stands up and he throws himself on the floor. "I am nothing. I am nothing." And tears are flowing from the eyes of the congregation. Everyone is so moved. And the pastor goes on speaking impassionately. And then from the back of the hall, the janitor comes running up. He throws himself before the pastor. "I am nothing. I am nothing." And the first rich man looks over at the second one and says, "Look who thinks he's nothing." So we're thinking our service, due to the mode of passion, is very important. But if we're actually in Krishna consciousness, then we understand it's just our little bit to offer to Krishna. And we've been chanting sincerely, by Krishna's grace, we have a little service to offer. We're grateful for that. So you talked about intelligence. There are four kinds of intelligence, right? So the worst kind is active foolish. The next worst kind is lazy foolish. The next best kind is active intelligence. So what's the best kind of intelligence? Yes, lazy intelligence. So if you talk about how to be free of the mode of passion and intelligence, then it means lazy intelligence. It means we keep things in perspective. The most important example of that I can give you. You know, I work in recruiting and training devotees. And I've come to understand that the relationship between the devotees is always more important than the service at the moment. So if I'm more caught up in the service than the relationship, I might say, "What are you doing? Come on, we need to hurry." And then I'm hurting our relationship. You see? So there's nothing that's more important, unless it's a matter of life and death. There's really nothing that's more important than the relationship. This is lazy intelligence. Okay, the thing may get done or may not get done, but it's more important that we attend. That's actually intelligence. Okay. So I hope that answers your question.
Hare Krishna. Thank you so much, Prabhu. That intelligence part is very nicely explained. And it makes a lot of sense to me. The devotion aspect, how do we actually connect to Krishna? Because the connection or that the richness of emotions in the heart is not always there.
The richness of emotions in the heart is not always there. So how do we have adequate bhakti? Yeah, that actually requires intelligence to understand that we are neophytes, that our bhakti is not very far along, but we have to give ourselves credit for what we are doing. Just like we have to give in that relationship. This person may be doing something wrong or something inefficient, but their intent is to serve Krishna, and I need to recognize that. See? And also, like I was giving that example earlier of being in the mode of passion and thinking, I'm not good enough. That means we're not sufficiently recognizing whatever little fledgling bhakti we have. And it's important in our spiritual growth that we recognize that. Maybe I'm not very far along in my bhakti, but I am trying and I am sincere.
I think you mentioned that point also about accepting ourselves,
yeah,
and self-appreciation. I think that also answers,
yes,
the question.
Same point,
yeah.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Prabhu.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, we don't have to be the best devotee. We're just average devotees, and that's okay. Other questions? Anything else? Okay, I think we've gone over time already. Okay. Right, Krishnanam Prabhu? 9:15? All right. Well, anyway, I really appreciate the chance to speak this morning and to be here with all of you. You are running a temple is a great inspiration for me to visit every time I get the opportunity. Thank you for all you're doing for Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Shri Radha Gopinath ki jai. Shri Radha Gopinath Mandir ki jai.